Welcome to the Occult London podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring magic, mysticism, the Kabbalah, as well as other topics. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, please take a moment to leave us a review and a rating on iTunes or wherever you tune in. It really helps more folks find us and helps us to continue to get this message out there. Also, don't forget to check out occultlondon.co.uk to subscribe. And if you're feeling extra supportive, consider backing us on Patreon, or you can find us on Buy Me A Coffee. Every little bit goes a long way in keeping this show alive. And a heartfelt thanks for all your kindness and support. Now let's dive into today's episode. In this episode, we continue our history of magical talismans and amulets, focusing on their significance in the early modern period, which really covers the period from the Golden Dawn up to the current neo-pagan practices. And this shift will help us to understand how these ancient magical practices have been reshaped to fit to different practitioners and also different belief systems as well. The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn really stands as a beacon in the history of magical orders from the late 19th to the early 20th century, conceived in 1888 by a trio of British Freemasons, William Wynne Westcott, Samuel Liddell MacGregor Mathers, and William Robert Woodman. And this institution really carved a distinct niche in the chronicles of magical orders. Drawing from a diverse range of mystical and magical traditions spanning from Kabbalah, Hermeticism, alchemy to Rosicrucianism, the Golden Dawn created an eclectic blend of beliefs and practices. And a significant part of these practices revolved around the use of and the creation of talismans. They viewed talismans not as just mere objects, but also as powerful tools that would be capable of capturing celestial and zodiacal and angelic forces into the material through the application of specific correspondences and ceremonial magical rituals. The Golden Dawn's philosophy towards talismanic magic is quite similar to that of Francis Barrett, but they kind of really enrich this approach with additional layers of complexity by integrating the concepts of Kabbalah and also the symbolic powers of colours. They enhance the potency of their magical practices. The definition of a talisman, as per the Golden Dawn, outlined in Israel Regardi's comprehensive book, is as follows. A talisman is a magical figure charged with the force which it is intended to represent. In the construction of a talisman, care should be taken to make it, as far as is possible, so to represent the universal forces that it should be in exact harmony with those you wish to attract. And the more exact the symbolism, the more easy it is to attract the force. Other things coinciding, such as consecration at the right time, etc. Before we continue, we need to have a little look at the Kabbalistic Tree of Life to give an example of how these correspondences worked. And the Tree of Life is a Kabbalistic diagram, represents the 10 aspects of God divided into Sephiroth. And these divisions are the crown, Keter, wisdom, Chokmah, understanding, Bina, mercy, Kesed, justice, Geburah, beauty, Tiferet, victory, Netzach, splendor, Hod, and then the foundation, Yesod, and finally the kingdom in Malkut. Each level or world has a tree that basically catalogues all of the different esoteric and spiritual knowledge into various different correspondences, which include the names of God, the archangels, the choir of angels, and also physical expressions of the four worlds, such as magical tools or minerals and things like that. So, for example, Tiferet has the divine name of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh Elohav-Dat, on the Atzeluthic level, the Archangel Raphael, or sometimes Michael on the second, the Briatic, the Malachim on the third, the Yetzirach, and then the mundane chakra, which is the sun, on the last level. And you also have a planetary spirit normally as well. So as well as using these complex systems of correspondences, the Golden Dawn also used different colour scales to add extra power to their magical systems. So each of the four Kabbalistic worlds, the Atzeluthic, the Briatic, Yetzirah and Desire, had a colour system which are known as the King, the Queen, the Prince and the Princess scales. And four trees of life were painted on these scales, and each Sephiroth was assigned a specific colour. Complementary colours were used to write magical names and sigils to enhance the flashing colour effect, which was believed to attract supernatural forces. And flashing colour tablets were created to trap planetary energy for use in talismans or other magical operations. Contrary to popular belief, the colour schemes within the Golden Dawn and other hermetic orders serve a purpose beyond mere aesthetics. For example, the magician W. Butler stated that these colours aren't merely to give the tree a festive appearance. Instead, they function as unique vibrations that bridge the gap between us and the spiritual powers or realities that we aim to attract or embody. And the roots of why each sphere is assigned a particular colour are complex and quite difficult to trace, to be honest. But nevertheless, the Golden Dawn colour scheme likely drew from, you know, a multitude of different sources, such as the Sefer Yetzirah, Eliphas Levi, and also colour theories such as Goethe's theory of colours. The magician Bill Heidrich beautifully summarises this concept in his book The Rose and the Scales, where he discusses the colour scale, saying the following. In the Sefer Yetzirah, Hebrew letters are classified into three types: three mother letters, seven double letters and 12 singles. This classification serves as a basis for deriving the colours. Within this structure we find Aleph, Mem and Shin. Aleph is represented by yellow, Mem by blue and Shin by red. These three primary colours serve as the foundation from which all other colours are derived. In the Sefer Yetzirah, Aleph corresponds to air, Mem to water and Shin to fire. And that's a quote by Bill Heidrich discussing the colours. And we may do an episode on some of the background to the kind of how the colours were formed. So in the art of talisman creation, the Golden Dawn magicians would employ the corresponding attributes related to a specific Sephiroth or planet. And this process would be imbues the otherwise inert talisman or materia with the spiritual force that it's intended to represent and intended to attract. And the accuracy of the symbolism increased the likelihood of attracting that desired power. Contrary to another common misconception, the primary aim of the Golden Dawn was to cultivate adepts to become their best possible selves. And the Mystery School really kind of encouraged graduates to apply their training in the great work to their chosen field. So one of the Order's primary methods was an initiatory system of rituals that was designed to awaken candidates to spiritual realities and their higher selves gradually. And while we won't delve into the intricate rituals here, it's worth noting that they are incredibly powerful and aesthetically impressive. And the robust structure of these rituals was also employed to charge talismans with divine energy. This belief that their initiation system could rejuvenate spiritually dormant candidates similarly believed it could infuse a talisman with spiritual power. And an illustration of this belief can be observed in the wording of the neophyte ritual from the Golden Dawn, which goes as follows. Inheritor of a dying world, we call thee to the living beauty. Wanderer in the wild darkness, we call thee to the gentle light. Child of earth, long hast thou dwelt in darkness. Quit the night and seek the day. The fundamental formula of the 0=0 initiation degree was meticulously crafted to guide candidates or talismans from the dim shadows of ignorance and enslavement and darkness towards a connection with their higher spiritual self. And this ritual initiates a transformative process that liberates the divine aspects of an individual from their material bonds and metaphorically is breathing life into what appeared lifeless. So it's not really surprising that this ceremony is also an excellent platform for charging a magical talisman or amulet and transforming it into a spiritually charged magical artifact. A statement from this ritual illustrates this concept. May the radiant white brilliance of the divine spirit descend upon this creature of talismans, filling it with the glory of your majesty, so that it forever aids me in aspiring towards the great work. The Golden Dawn talisman creation method was quite intricate, with the technique applied to all of their magical equipment as well. And as their influence kind of faded, although I know it's still going at the moment, other magicians did begin to, you know, look at other more streamlined ways of creating talismans. After the Golden Dawn era, there's often kind of perceived stagnation in terms of magical development. And a lot of magicians continued to utilize the structure that the Golden Dawn had put together. So authors like Dion Fortune, you know, W.E. Butler, they don't really write extensively about it, but it's thought that they probably would have used a similar kind of system. However, the contributions of Madeleine Montalban were also important in regards to talismans and angel magic. British-born Madeleine Sylvia Montalban, 1910 to 1982, emerged as a prominent figure in the field of astrology and the occult during the mid-20th century, and her methods and approach to magic were distinctly original, eschewing the traditions of her peers such as the Order of the Golden Dawn and Dion Fortune's Fraternity of the Inner Light. Instead of tracing a specific lineage or purporting to have communication with inner plane masters, etc., Montalban really crafted her own unique system of magic, which was steeped in individual research and also infused with the spirit of hermetic magic that was practiced during the Italian Renaissance and other earlier influences. So for over three decades, her writing filled the pages of quite a few popular high street magazine, and particularly the magazine Prediction, with her monthly horoscope predictions and also articles on things like tarot, astrology and magic. And she also supplemented her income by writing romantic novels and offering tarot reading to various different clients. In 1959, Montalban established her own magical society, the Ordo Stella Matutina, also known as the Order of the Morning Star. And this initiation really followed a mystical encounter with the angel Lucifer, whom she preferred to address as Lord Lumiel, or the Light of God. In the outer court of the order, Montalban created a correspondence course on angel magic, and this course encompassed a magical system that drew upon a wide array of sources such as Francis Barrett's The Magus, Agrippa, The Key of Solomon, The Book of Abraham and the Mage, John Dee's Enochian Magic, the writings of Paracelsus and also Aleister Crowley, as well as obviously her own guidance from the inner realms, from the angels. Her devoted student Rick Hayward wrote the following about Madeleine Montalban. Being a journalist by trade, she was adept at drawing together various strands of occult thought and tradition. The final result was a system of operative magic that was extremely workable without being over complex. The basic rituals were based on the lunar cycle, utilising the planetary energies or angels to bring about the desired results. Montalban's pedagogy provided her students really with a solid foundation in magical principles, including a deep understanding of the Hermetic axiom, as above, so below. They also learned about occult correspondences from the Arabic and Kabbalistic origins, and also how each celestial body in the solar system is ruled over by a specific spirit or angelic regiment. Montalban also taught that by comprehending and wielding this knowledge, it should be used in a very practical way so a magician can actually shape their reality, make changes in their life through using these divine forces. And her methods utilise a lot of different, you know, metals, gems, etc. In terms of these creating these talismans. Montalban's teaching style stressed kind of personal guidance, really, over rituals or ceremonies. And this also allowed her students to adapt the practices to their personal needs and preferences. And she also created a lot of different talismans, particularly that were personalized on an individual's astrological chart as well. And each one of these talismans was unique, typically made from, you know, specific materials. As we spoke before, there's a whole correspondences of different metals or symbols, sigils that you'd carve onto them. But she believed that the talismans could be charged with all the relevant planetary and elemental magic energies to function effectively. She also used the significant timing that we've discussed before, so assisting on aligning with particular astrological aspects and planetary hours to infuse the correct energies. Montalban articulated her insights on timing in her writings, noting that other planetary factors also played a crucial role. For example, she wrote the following: during this time, I acquired the knowledge of how to melt and purify pure silver, and I discovered that good results were not merely obtained by working when the moon was in Cancer, that being only part of the secret. Certain other planets had to be in good aspect too, with the sun occupying either a watery or airy sign at the time. By combining all these factors and using trial and error, I discovered that I could fashion a magically pure silver sheet with a powerful vibration all of its own and distinguished in some special way from the silver made when only the moon occupied its designated place. So one aspect of Montalban's system was the creation of letters addressed to primary archangels, scripted in a unique alphabet called Passing the River, and also the Theban script. And after completion of the task, these letters would be ceremonially burnt. And her system emphasized establishing connections with inner entities and using specific invocations, an approach that's still widely used, particularly in Alexandrian Wicca today. Another interesting thing about Montalban was she had a method to assess a talisman's effectiveness. So practitioners would ask for signs from the entities or spirits empowering the talisman to verify their active participation. And these earthly checks or following signs were integral to the system. And we see that later on with some other practitioners where we you can measure the effectiveness or how charged your talisman is by using a pendulum. Another important figure in the history of talismanic magic is Austin Osmond Spare, 1886 to 1956. He was an accomplished British artist and occultist and is particularly celebrated for his artistic approach and distinctive magical philosophy. He embarked on his creative journey at an impressively young age and swiftly gained recognition for his talented in captivating audiences with his art and his drawings in London, but also the broader art world. In addition to being a prolific artist, Speer was deeply fascinated with the occult and magic, and actually developed his own unique magical system known as the Gzoskaya Cultus. His artwork was very richly symbolic and brimming with elements of magic and mysticism, and this really kind of mirrors his intrigue with the occult. Despite his artistic accomplishments, unfortunately, his fame remained relatively subdued in his lifetime, and it's not really until after his death that his artwork has gained wider acclaim as well. But in terms of his magic, art and magic were inseparable and really intertwined in his approach, as echoed is in his description of art. "Only art is eternal wisdom. What is not art soon perishes. Art is the unconscious love of all things. Learning will cease, and reality will become known when it comes to pass that every being is an artist." And this statement really encapsulates Speer's belief that art expresses the boundless and the ineffable, which defies logical formula, but remains authentic and vibrant. Just like magic, art communicates its essence through symbolism, both serving as avenues to transcend the restrictions of the material world and interact with the divine. And the approach to talismanic that Speer took introduces intriguing perspectives to our discussion. He championed innovative methods and magical techniques that discarded the Golden Dawn's glitzy and kind of lengthy ceremonies, and he emphasizes the power of intent and directing the subconscious mind's ability to manifest desires into reality through sigils. Speer elucidated the concept of a magical sigil as follows. "Sigils are monograms of thought for the government of energy, a mathematical means of symbolizing desire and giving it form, that has the virtue of preventing any thought and association on that particular desire, escaping the detection of the ego, so that it does not restrain or attach such desire to its own transitory images, memories and worries, but allows it free passage to the subconsciousness." And also, "Sigils, the means used and the way it happens are simple, the inverse of scientific. I use a formula created by instinctive guess and arbitrarily formed, not evolved by hypothesis and experiment. The law of sorcery is its own law, using sympathetic symbols." So in Speer's worldview, the sigil physically embodies a wish, and the magician's desire crystallizes around the sigil or the symbol, becoming a vessel radiating their magical yearning. The sigil transforms into the magical manifestation of the wish and also acts as a vehicle to operationalize it and externalize it. It acts as a conduit to access the unconscious by infusing the magical intent into it and subconsciously manipulating energy or information to realize a desired outcome. And Speer's ideas about the mechanics of sigil magic really provides a very popular structure for quite successful magical practices. Shamanic practices also involved direct interactions with the magician's consciousness, achieved through usually rigorous discipline or psychoactive substances as well. And in the same way, ceremonial magical systems can be effective if the subconscious has been trained to identify and really act upon that symbolic language. And so this explains the extended training and religious instruction that's often in lots of different magical traditions. The symbols themselves don't possess magical power, but it's the subconscious manipulation of these symbols that holds the power. An important word in Spare's system is the word desire, and this is really pivotal in his magical universe. And he employed the aforementioned principles to really streamline his magical system, Zos, and created an alphabet of desire using sigils. His sigil magic method uses personalized glyphs and symbols to bridge the conscious and the subconscious mind. So this is quite different from the traditional talismanic magic that we've discussed in the, you know, the Renaissance episodes or some of the other earlier episodes, which uses often a predetermined symbol to enhance a physical object that's carried as a charm. Spare's sigils are designed to yield specific outcomes and are typically used only once. And Spare's typical method for creating his talismans or sigils would involve writing out one's intention, removing the repeated letters in a sentence, and then merging the remaining letters to form a magical sigil. And this aims to basically create an image that bypasses the psychic centre and also enters the subconscious mind and becomes magically effective and charged. And the more holy and satisfying this image was to the creator, the more effective it was thought to be. He would then concentrate on the sigil with all his attention to energize it, and as well as using other methods, which I won't go into in this podcast, before attempting to forget about it. And this act of forgetting is an essential part of the process. So according to Spare, a sigil whose meaning is consciously remembered when it is charged is a sigil that will not work. So the magician should devise a way to forget the purpose behind a sigil to ensure its effectiveness. One of the significant advantages of Spare's system is that it does not require any particular belief system or religious beliefs or even special equipment beyond a pen or pencil and some paper. The construction of the sigil has three parts: formulating a sentence of desire, converting the sentence into a glyph, and implanting the glyph into the subconscious. And as is the case with magic, one of the difficult things is, you know, working out what you want, obviously, and then the very difficult thing is going to be forgetting about the sigil and going on with your life. So it needs to be something that you want, but you can almost forget about it and let it do its work. This process is described by Kenneth Grant, who was a student of Austin Osmond Spare, as follows. The method he, Austin Osmond Spare, devised for activating the sigil was remarkably simple. Having formed the glyph, he would concentrate it, allowing his mind to drift into a state of reverie until it was hovering on the threshold of sleep. At this point, he would flash the image of the sigil onto the screen of his inner vision, and then with a supreme effort of will, banish it from his consciousness. This was intended to generate a kind of magical vacuum, which would draw the sigil towards its goal, in effect causing it to manifest in the world. And Spare describes this process himself as follows. The sigil is a means of symbolising desire and giving it form. To create a sigil, one must first identify the desire to be manifested. This desire is then condensed into a single statement or phrase, which is then reworked and manipulated until it becomes a unique abstract symbol. Creating a symbol involves intense concentration and focus, in which the conscious mind is temporarily suspended and the subconscious is allowed to generate and shape the symbol. Once the sigil is created, it must be charged with energy and released into the universe to manifest the desired outcome. An intriguing application of this technique can be found in an anecdote that involved Austin Osmond Spare, which Kenneth Grant elaborates on in his book, The Magical Revival, writing, "When Spare was 17, he stayed at the home of the Reverend Robert Hugh Benson, author of the Necromancers and other occult novels. They took a walk on a summer day with a serene and cloudless blue sky overhead. The day had been clear throughout, piquing Benson's curiosity about whether Spare could induce rain by magical means under such unlikely conditions. Spare asserted that he could, traced a sigil on the back of a used envelope, and stood still, focusing attention on it. Within 10 minutes, small clouds started to form, clustered at a point directly above them, and unleashed a violent downpour. Both Benson and Spare were soaked to the bone. As we can see, of the vital facet of the sigil creation process that Spare developed is the necessity of forgetting the sigil once it's complete. The creator must avoid consciously thinking about it, so instead they should focus on the sigil during the magical time, which is a term that refers to any instance when an individual undergoes emotional or elemental responses such as orgasm, pleasure, pain, or anger. So it's using that emotional power, or the power of Netzach, to charge up the talisman. And Spare conceives of the idea of magical time as being this kind of flexible notion that, depending on the temperament of the sigil's creator, and he offers a kind of a range of different examples of what it could encompass, including mantras, postures, wine, walking, etc., all while concentrating on the sigil. And this method is really still used, you know, by a lot of different contemporary magicians and practitioners of Wicca, chaos magic, and other systems as well. Kenneth Grant wrote about Spare: "Spare's system of sigilization is more than a form of art. It is a magical system in itself, and its efficacy is beyond doubt. He saw the process of sigilization as a method of reprogramming the subconscious mind by means of a self-induced trance state into achieving any desired goal." And in recent times, these ideas and things that people like the Golden Dawn, Montalban, and Spare have continued to evolve. And in the next episode, we will be continuing on with our discussion about some of the more modern expressions of talismanic magic. I'd like to finish this episode with a section of a poem by W.B. Yeats titled Supernatural Songs. "Because you have found me in the pitch dark night, with open book you ask me what I do. Mark and digest my tale, carry it afar to those that never saw this tonsured head, nor heard this voice that 90 years have cracked. Of Baal and Aelin you need not speak. All know their tale, all know what leaf and twig, what juncture of the apple and the yew surmount their bones, but speak what have none have heard. The miracle that gave them such a death, transfigured to pure substance, what had once been bone and sinew, when such bodies join. There is no touching here, nor touching there, nor straining joy, but whole is joined to whole, for the intercourse of angels is a light, where for its moment both seems lost, consumed. Here in the pitch dark atmosphere above, the trembling of the apple and the yew, here on the anniversary of their death, the anniversary of their first embrace, those lovers purified by tragedy, hurry into each other's arms, these eyes, by water herb and solitary prayer, made aquiline, are open to that light. Though somewhat broken by the leaves, that light lies in a circle on the grass therein. I turn the pages of my holy book."